Chapter 5. Father Captain DeSoya deadheaded from Pacham System on the HHS Ragel, an Archangel-class cruiser similar to the ship he had been ordered to command, killed by the terrible vortex of the classified instantaneous drive, known to Pax Fleet now as the Gideon Drive. DeSoya was resurrected in 2 days rather than the usual three, the resurrection chaplains taking the added risk of unsuccessful resurrection because of the urgency of the Father Captain's orders, and found himself at the Omicron II Epsilon III Pax Fleet Strategic Positioning Station, orbiting a lifeless, rocky world spinning in the darkness beyond Epsilon Eridani in the old neighborhood, only a handful of light years from where old Earth had once existed. DeSoya was given 1 day to recover his faculties and was then shuttled to the Omicron II Epsilon III fleet staging area, 100,000 clicks out from the military base. The midshipman piloting the WASP shuttle went out of his way to give Father Captain DeSoya a good look at his new command, and, despite himself, DeSoya was thrilled with what he saw. The HHS Raphael was obviously state-of-the-art technology, no longer derivative, as all of the previous Pax ships DeSoya had seen had been, of rediscovered hegemony designs from before the fall. The overall design seemed too lean for practical vacuum work and too complicated for atmosphere. But the overall effect was one of streamlined lethality. The hull was a composite of morphable alloys and areas of pure fixed energy, allowing rapid shape and function changes that would have been impossible a few years before. As the shuttle passed the Raphael in a long, slow, ballistic arc, DeSoya watched the exterior of the long ship go from chrome silver to a stealth matte black, essentially disappearing from view. At the same time, several of the instrument booms and living cubbies were swallowed by the smooth central hull, until only weapons blisters and containment field probes remained. Either the ship was preparing for out-system translation checks, or the officers aboard knew very well that the passing WASP carried their new commander and they were showing off a bit. DeSoya knew that both assumptions were almost certainly true. Before the cruiser blacked into oblivion, DeSoya noticed how the fusion drive spheres had been clustered like pearls around the central ship's axis, rather than concentrated in a single swelling, such as on his old torch ship, the Balthazar. He also noticed how much smaller the hexagonal Gideon drive array was on this ship than on the prototype Raphael. His last glimpse before the ship became invisible was of the lights glowing from the retracted, translucent living cubbies and the clear dome of the command deck. During combat, DeSoya knew from his reading on Pacham and the RNA instructional injections he had received at Pax Fleet headquarters, that these clear areas would morph thicker, armored epidermises, but DeSoya had always enjoyed a view and would appreciate the window into space.
"Coming up on the Uriel, sir," said the midshipman pilot.
DeSoya nodded. The HHS Uriel seemed a near clone of the new Raphael, but as the WASP shuttle decelerated closer, the Father Captain could pick out the extra Omega knife generators, the added glowing conference cubbies, and the more elaborate comm antennae that made this vessel the flagship of the task force.
"Docking warning, sir," said the midshipman.
DeSoya nodded and took his seat on the number 2 acceleration couch. The matting was smooth enough that he felt no jolt whatsoever as the connection clamps closed and the ship's skin and umbilicals morphed around the shuttle. DeSoya was tempted to praise the young midshipman, but old habits of command reasserted themselves.
"Next time," he said, "try the final approach without the last-second flare. It's showing off, and the brass on a flagship frown on it."
The young pilot's face fell. DeSoya set a hand on her shoulder.
"Other than that, good job. I'd have you aboard my ship as a dropship pilot any day."
The crestfallen midshipman brightened.
"I could only wish, sir, this station duty..."
She stopped, realizing that she had gone too far.
"I know," said DeSoya, standing by the cycling lock. I know. But for now, be glad that you're not part of this crusade. The lock cycled open, and an honor guard whistled him aboard the HHS Uriel. The Archangel, if Father Captain DeSoya remembered correctly, that the Old Testament had described as the leader of the heavenly hosts of angels. 90 light-years away, in a star system only 3 light-years from Pachim, the original Raphael translated into real space with a violence that would have spit marrow from human bones, sliced through human cells like a hot blade through radiant gossamers, and scrambled human neurons like loose marbles on a steep hillside. Radamanth Nemis and her clone siblings did not enjoy the sensation, but neither did they cry out nor grimace. "Where is this place?" said Nemis, watching a brown planet grow in the view screen. Raphael was decelerating under 230 gravities. Nemis did not sit in the acceleration couch, but she did hang on to a stanchion with the casual ease of a commuter on her way to work in a crowded ground bus. "Svoboda," said one of her 2 male siblings. Nemis nodded. None of the 4 spoke again until the Archangel was in orbit and the dropship detached and howling through thin air. "He'll be here?" asked Nemis. Microfilaments ran from her temples directly into the dropship console. "Oh, yes," said Nemis's twin sister. A few humans lived on Svoboda, but since the fall they had huddled in force field domes in the Twilight Zone and did not have the technology to track the Archangel or its dropship. There were no Pax bases in this system. Meanwhile, the sunward side of the rocky world boiled until lead ran like water, and on the dark side the thin atmosphere hovered on the edge of freezing. Beneath the useless planet, however, ran more than 800,000 kilometers of tunnels, each corridor a perfect 30 meters square. Svoboda was one of 9 labyrinthine worlds discovered in the early days of the Hegira and explored during the hegemony. Hyperion had been another of the 9 worlds. No human, alive or dead, knew the secret of the labyrinths or their creators. Nemes piloted the dropship through a pelting ammonia storm on the dark side, hovered an instant before an ice cliff, visible only on infrared and amplification screens, and then folded the ship's wings in and guided it forward into the square opening of the labyrinth entrance. This tunnel turned once and then stretched straight on for kilometers. Deep radar showed a honeycomb of other passages beneath it. Nemes flew forward 3 clicks, turned left at the first junction of tunnels, dropped half a kilometer from the surface while traveling 5 clicks south, and then landed the ship. Here, the infrared showed only trace heat from lava vents, and the amplifier showed nothing on the view screen. Frowning at the return on the radar displays, Nemes flipped on the dropship's exterior lights. For as far as she could see down the infinitely straight corridor, the walls of the tunnel had been carved into a row of horizontal stone slabs. On each slab was a naked human body. The slabs and bodies continued on and on into darkness. Nemes glanced at the deep radar display. The lower levels were also striated with slabs and bodies. "Outside," said the male sibling who had pulled Nemes from the lava on God's Grove. Nemes did not bother with the airlock. Atmosphere rushed out of the dropship with a dying roar. There was a hint of pressure in the cavern, enough that she would not have to phase shift to survive, but the air was thinner than Mars had been before it was terraformed. Nemes's personal sensors indicated that the temperature was steady at -162 degrees centigrade. A human figure was outside waiting in the dropship's floodlights.
"Good evening," said Counselor Albedo.
The tall man was impeccably dressed in a gray suit tailored to Pachim tastes. He communicated directly on the 75 megahertz band. Albedo's mouth did not move, but his perfect teeth were visible in a smile. Nemes and her siblings waited. She knew that there would be no further reprimands or punishment. The 3 sectors wanted her alive and functioning.
"The girl, Anea, has returned to Pax Space," said Albedo. Where? Said Nemesis's female sibling. There was something like eagerness between the flat tones of her voice. Counselor Albedo opened his hands. The portal, began Nemes. Tells us nothing this time, said Counselor Albedo. His smile had not wavered. Nemes frowned at this. During all the centuries of the hegemony's world web, the three sectors of consciousness of the core had not found a way to use the void portal, that instantaneous interface that humans had known as farcasters, without leaving a record of modulated neutrinos in the fold matrix. "The something else," she said. "Of course," said Albedo. He flicked his hand as if discarding the useless segment of this conversation. "But we can still register the connection. We feel sure that the girl is among those returning from old Earth via the old farcaster network." "There are others?" said one of the males. Albedo nodded. "A few at first, more now. At least 50 activations at last count." Nemes folded her arms. "Do you think that something else is terminating the old Earth experiment?" "No," said Albedo. He walked over to the nearest slab and looked down at the naked human body on it. It had been a young woman, no more than 17 or 18 standard years old. She had red hair. White frost lay on her pale skin and open eyes. "No," he said again. "The sectors agree that it is just Ania's group returning." "How do we find her?" said Nemesis's female sibling, obviously musing aloud on the 75 megahertz band. "We can translate to every world that had a farcaster during the hegemony and interrogate the farcaster portals in person." Albedo nodded. "The something else can conceal the farcast destinations," he said, "but the core is almost certain that it cannot hide the fact of the matrix fold itself." Almost certain. Nemes noted that unusual modifier of techno-core perceptions. "We want you," began Albedo, pointing at the female sibling. "The stable sector did not give you a name, did it?"
"No," said Nemes's twin.
Limp, dark bangs fell over the pale forehead. No smile touched the thin lips. Albedo chuckled on the 75 megahertz band. "Radamanth Nemes needed a name to pass as a human crewmate on the Raphael. I think that the rest of you should be named, if just for my convenience." He pointed at the female. "Scylla." Stabbing his finger at each of the males in turn, he said, "Gyges, Briareus." None of the three responded to their christenings, but Nemes folded her arms and said, "Does this amuse you, Counselor?"
"Yes," said Albedo.
Around them, the atmosphere vented from the dropship curled and broiled like a wicked fog. The male now named Briareus said, "We'll keep this archangel for transport and begin searching all the old web worlds, beginning, I assume, with the River Tethys planets."
"Yes," said Albedo.
Scylla tapped her nails on the frozen fabric of her jumpsuit.
"Four ships, the search would go 4 times as fast."
"Obviously," said Albedo. "There are several reasons we have decided against that. The first being that the Pax has few of these archangel ships free to loan."
Nemes raised an eyebrow.
"And when has the Corps asked the Pax for loans?"
"Since we need their money and their factories and their human resources to build the ships," said Albedo without emphasis. "The second and final reason is that we want the four of you together in case you encounter someone or something impossible for one of you to handle."
Nemes's eyebrow stayed up. She expected some reference to her failure on God's Grove, but it was Gyges who spoke.
"What in the Pax could we not handle, Counselor?"
Again the man in gray opened his hands. Behind him, the curling vapors of fog first obscured and then revealed the pale bodies on slabs.
"The Shrike," he said.
Nemes made a rude noise on the 75 megahertz band.
"I beat the thing single-handedly," she said.
Albedo shook his head. The maddening smile stayed fixed.
"No," he said, "you did not. You used the hyperentropic device with which we supplied you to send it 5 minutes into the future. That is not the same as beating it."
Briareus said, "The Shrike is no longer under the control of the UI.
Albedo opened his hands a final time. The gods of the future no longer whisper to us, my expensive friend. They war among themselves, and the clamor of their battle echoes back through time. If our God's work is to be done in our time, we must do it ourselves. He looked at the four clone siblings. Are we clear on instructions?
Find the girl, said Scylla.
And? Said the counselor.
Kill her at once, said Gyges, no hesitation.
And if her disciples intervene? Said Albedo, smiling more broadly now, his voice the caricature of a human schoolteacher's.
Kill them, said Briareus.
And if the shrike appears? He said, the smile suddenly fading.
Destroy it, said Nemes.
Albedo nodded. Any final questions before we go our separate ways? Scylla said.
How many humans are here?
She gestured toward the slabs and bodies.
Counselor Albedo touched his chin.
A few tens of millions on this labyrinthine world, in this section of tunnels. But there are many more tunnels here, he smiled again, and 8 more labyrinth worlds.
Nemes slowly turned her head, viewing the swirling fog and receding line of stone slabs on various levels of the spectrum. None of the bodies showed any sign of heat above the ambient temperature of the tunnel.
And this is the Pax's work, she said.
Albedo chuckled on the 75 megahertz band. Of course, he said. Why would the 3 sectors of consciousness or our future UI want to stockpile human bodies?
He walked over to the body of the young woman and tapped her frozen breast. The air in the cavern was far too thin to carry sound, but Nemes imagined the noise of cold marble being tapped by fingernails.
Any more questions? Said Albedo. I have an important meeting.
Without a word on the 75 megahertz band, or any other band, the 4 siblings turned and re-entered the dropship. Gathered on the circular tactical conference center blister of the HHS Uriel were 20 Pax Fleet officers, including all of the captains and executive officers of Task Force Gideon. Among those executive officers was Commander Hogan Hoag Liebler. 36 standard years old, born again since his baptism on Renaissance Minor, the scion of the once great Liebler Freehold family, whose estate covered some 2 million hectares, and whose current debt ran to almost 5 marks per hectare, Liebler had dedicated his private life to serving the church and given his professional life to Pax Fleet. He was also a spy and a potential assassin. Liebler had looked up with interest as his new commanding officer was piped aboard the Uriel. Everyone in the task force, almost everyone in Pax Fleet, had heard of Father Captain DeSoya. The former Torchship CO had been granted a papal diskey, meaning almost unlimited authority, for some secret project 5 standard years earlier, and then had failed at his mission. No one was sure what that mission had been, but DeSoya's use of that diskey had made enemies among fleet officers across the Pax. The Father Captain's subsequent failure and disappearance had been cause for more rumor in the wardrooms and fleet staff rooms. The most accepted theory was that DeSoya had been turned over to the Holy Office, had been quietly excommunicated, and probably executed. But now here he was, given command of one of the most treasured assets in Pax Fleet's arsenal, one of the 21 operational Archangel cruisers. Liebler was surprised at DeSoya's appearance. The Father Captain was short, dark-haired, with large, sad eyes more appropriate to the icon of a martyred saint than to the skipper of a battlecruiser. Introductions were made quickly by Admiral Aldecacti, the stocky Lusian in charge of both this meeting and the task force.
Father Captain DeSoya, said Aldecacti, as DeSoya took his place at the gray circular table within the gray circular room. I believe you know some of these officers.
The Admiral was famous for her lack of tact as well as for her ferocity in battle.
Mother Captain Stone is an old friend, said DeSoya, nodding toward his former executive officer. Captain Hearn was a member of my last task force.
and I have met Captain Satie and Captain Lempriere. I have also had the privilege of working with Commanders Uchikawa and Barnes Avni."
Admiral Aldecacti grunted.
"Commander Barnes Avni is here representing the Marine and Swiss Guard presence on Task Force Gideon," she said. "Have you met your exec, Father Captain DeSoya?"
The priest captain shook his head, and Aldecacti introduced Liebler. The commander was surprised at the firmness in the diminutive Father Captain's grip and the authority in the other man's gaze. "Eyes of a martyr or no," thought Hoag Liebler, "this man is used to command."
"All right," growled Admiral Aldecacti. "Let's get started. Captain Satie will present the briefing."
For the next 20 minutes, the conference blister was fogged with hollows and trajectory overlays, comm logs and scribers filled with data and scribbled notes. Satie's soft voice was the only sound except for the rare question or request for clarification. Liebler jotted his own notes, surprised at the scope of Task Force Gideon's mission, and busy at the work of any executive officer, getting down all the salient facts and details that the captain might want to review later. Gideon was the first task force made up completely of Archangel-class cruisers. 7 of the Archangels had been tasked to this mission. Conventional Hawking-class torch ships had been dispatched months earlier to rendezvous with them at their first sally point in the outback, some 20 light-years beyond the Great Wall defensive sphere, so as to participate in a mock battle. But after that first jump, the task force of 7 ships would be operating independently.
"A good metaphor would be General Sherman's march through Georgia in the pre-Hegira North American Civil War in the 19th century," said Captain Satie, sending half the officers of the table tapping at their comm log disk keys to bring up that arcane bit of military history.
"Previously," continued Satie, "our battles with the Ousters have either been in the Great Wall No Man's Land or on the fringes of either Pax or Ouster space. There have been very few deep penetration raids into Ouster territory."
Satie paused in his briefing.
"Father Captain DeSoya's Task Force Magi some 5 standard years ago was one of the deepest of those raids."
"Any comments about it, Father Captain?" said Admiral Aldecacti.
DeSoya hesitated a moment.
"We burned an orbital forest ring," he said at last. "There was no resistance."
Hoag Liebler thought that the Father Captain's voice sounded vaguely ashamed. Satie nodded as if satisfied.
"That's what we hope will be the case for this entire mission. Our intelligence suggests that the Ousters have deployed the vast bulk of their defensive forces along the sphere of the Great Wall, leaving very little in the way of armed resistance through the heart of their colonized areas beyond the Pax. For almost 3 centuries they have positioned their forces, their bases, and their home systems with the limitations of Hawking Drive technology as the primary determining factor."
Tactical hollows filled the conference blister.
"The grand cliché," continued Satie, "is that the Pax has had the advantage of interior lines of transport and communication, while the Ousters have had the defensive strength of concealment and distance. Penetration deep into Ouster space has been all but impossible due to the vulnerability of our supply lines and their willingness to cut and run before our superior strength, attacking later, often with devastating effect, when our task forces venture too far from the Great Wall."
Satie paused and looked at the officers around the table.
"Gentlemen and ladies, those days are over."
More hollows misted into solidity. The red line of Task Force Gideon's trajectory out from and back to the Pax sphere, slicing between suns like a laser knife.
"Our mission is to destroy every in-system Ouster supply base and deep space colony we encounter," said Satie, his soft voice taking on strength. "Comet farms, canned cities, boondoggles, Taurus bases, L-point clusters, orbital forest rings, birthing asteroids, bubble hives, everything."
"Including civilian angels?" asked Father Captain DeSoya. Hoag Liebler blinked at his CO's question. Pax Fleet informally referred to the space-tailored DNA-altered mutants as Lucifer's Angels, usually shortened to Angels in an irony bordering on blasphemy, but the phrase was rarely used before the high brass.
Admiral Aldecacti answered.
"Especially angels, Father Captain. His Holiness Pope Urban has declared this a crusade against the inhuman travesties the ousters are breeding out there in the darkness. His Holiness has stated in his crusade encyclical that these unholy mutations are to be eliminated from God's universe. There are no civilian ousters. Do you have a problem understanding this directive, Father Captain DeSoya?"
Officers around the table seemed to hold their breaths until DeSoya finally answered.
"No, Admiral Aldecacti. I understand His Holiness is encyclical."
The briefing continued.
"These Archangel-class cruisers will be involved," said Sati. "His Holiness's ship, Uriel, as flagship, the Raphael, the Michael, the Gabriel, the Raguel, the Remiel, and the Sariel. In each case, the ships will use their Gideon drives to make the instantaneous jump to the next system. Will take 2 days or more to decelerate in-system, thus allowing time for crew resurrection. His Holiness has granted us dispensation to use the new 2-day resurrection cycle creches, which offer a 92% probability of resurrection. After regrouping the attack force, we will do maximum damage to all ouster forces and installations before translating to the next system. Any Pax ship damaged beyond repair will be abandoned, the crew transferred to other ships in the task force, and the cruiser destroyed. No chances will be taken with the ousters capturing Gideon Drive technology, even though it would be useless to them without the sacrament of resurrection. The mission should extend some 3 standard months. Any questions?
Father Captain DeSoya raised his hand.
"I have to apologize," he said. "I've been out of touch for several standard years. But I notice that this task force is made up of Archangel-class ships, named after archangels referred to by name in the Old Testament."
"Yes, Father Captain?" prompted Admiral Aldecacti. "Your question?"
"Just this, Admiral. I seem to remember that there were only 7 archangels referred to by name in the Bible. What about the rest of the Archangel-class ships that have come online?"
There was chuckling around the long table, and DeSoya could see that he had cut the tension much as he had planned.
Smiling, Admiral Aldecacti said,
"We welcome our prodigal captain back and inform him that the Vatican theologians have searched the Book of Enoch and the rest of the pseudo-epigrapha to find these other angels which might be promoted to honorary archangel, and the Holy Office itself has authorized dispensation in Pax Fleet's use of their names. We found it appropriate that the first 7 planet-class archangels built be named after those listed in the Bible and should carry their sacred fire to the enemy."
The chuckling turned to sounds of approval and finally to soft applause among the commanders and their execs. There were no other questions. Admiral Aldecacti said,
"Oh, one other detail. If you see this ship..."
A hollow of a strange-looking starship floated above the center of the table. The thing was small by Pax Fleet standards, was streamlined as if built to enter atmosphere, and had fins near the fusion ports.
"What is it?"
said Mother Captain Stone, still smiling from the good feeling in the room. "Some ouster joke?"
"No," said Father Captain DeSoya in a soft monotone. "It's Web-era technology, a private starship, owned by an individual."
A few executive officers chuckled again. Admiral Aldecacti stopped the laughter by waving her thick hand through the hollow.
"The Father Captain is correct," rumbled the Lusian Admiral. "It's an old Web-era ship, once owned by a diplomat of the hegemony."
She shook her head.
"They had the wealth to make such gestures then. Anyway, it has a Hawking drive modified by ouster technicians, may well be armed, and must be considered as dangerous."
"What do we do if we encounter it?" asked Mother Captain Stone. "Take it as a prize?"
"No," said Admiral Aldecacti. "Destroy it on sight. Slag it to vapor. Any questions?"
There were none. The officers dispersed to their ships to prepare for the initial translation. On the Wasp shuttle ride back to the Raphael, XO Hoag Liebler chatted pleasantly with his new captain about the ship's readiness and crew's high morale, all the while thinking, "I hope I don't have to kill this man."